Digital Drift, episode 27, recorded Wednesday, the 23rd of July, 2014, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Yours. I want to protect mine. It's our only chance for peace.
Are you aware?
No!
They are going to turn on you.
They're animals!
Caesar, you're home.
Who was that?
A good man like you.
Caesar, love humans more than apes.
If you threaten his family, he will retaliate.
Don't shoot! Don't you move!
Should we shoot him?
Maybe.
Oh, hey, whoa, whoa. Hey.
Oh, you want a drink?
Oh, oh, hey. All right.
Easy.
Easy.
All right.
What are you doing?
I'm saving the human race. Ah!
Military! They're already on their way!
Caesar, you have to go.
Go where? This is my home. I'm sorry, my friend. War has begun.
Caesar!
After a very strong box office success for their reboot, Fox realized they had Ape hit on their hands and greenlit a sequel immediately. Director Rupert Wyatt was replaced by Matt Reeves, and writers Rick Jaffa and Amanda Silver worked with a new edition of Mark Bomback. Jaffa and Silver both co-produced as well, along with Peter Chernin and Dylan Clark, so this really does retain the feel of a consistent creative team. A third movie, most likely entitled War of the Planet of the Apes, is inbound and due in 2016. 3 years on from 2011's Rise, and Caesar returns with his family, though 10 years have elapsed in the movie world. It is a very different planet we rejoin. After the pandemic spread, mankind was divided into pockets, unable to connect or communicate with one another, scrabbling desperately to keep their families alive in a hostile world. The apes, however, have gone back to nature, adapting perfectly to their forest surroundings and taking on the trappings of primitive man. Their secrecy, hidden in the woods near San Francisco, and the panic about everything else is what has kept them alive all this time. But now the humans are at their gates. They want access to their old electrical power, and their discovery of the simian tribe creates unbearable hostility and tension as bitterness, paranoia and hatred on both sides fuels the fires of war. Can Caesar keep the peace between man and human, or will violence prevail, precipitating more drastic change? Cloverfield, Let Me In, and Under Siege 2 : Dark Territory director Matt Reeves said, "When I came in, late 2012, after Rupert Wyatt left, as he felt 2 years wasn't enough time to make a great movie, Franco and Pinto were not rehired as a result, the movie that they were going to do was quite different from the movie we ended up doing. Well, the original thing, they gave me an outline that they had put together. Mark Bomback, Die Hard 4, Total Recall, The Wolverine, 50 Shades of Grey, who wrote the script, they were going to have him write this outline. And this outline started in the post-apocalyptic San Francisco, and the apes came down into the city and started pushing up power lines, and they started living together, both species, in the city. And the ape could really speak very articulately, and it was entirely different. And it wasn't even a story. And I said, guys, do you realize the miracle that you guys pulled off with Rise? It's a movie in which the secret is that it's not a human point of view story at all. That movie is Caesar's. That's amazing. Now, Reeves insisted that Bombat took another pass at it, and eventually they came around to something that seems like it was intended from the very beginning, to be a second pass at the previously botched premise of Battle for the Planet of the Apes. Now, this time, it was made with an understanding of how people work, the immense difficulty of finding an accord with one's aggressors, extremely good actors, I might add, and a clearly anti-war stance, very unusual for a summer blockbuster, very. Another way of looking at it is James Cameron's Avatar in shades of grey rather than black and white. Just for you folks at home, we saw this on separate occasions. Because we are now in a different situation, we can now go, we can walk to the cinema, which means we don't have to pile into the car and go and see it all together on a Saturday or a Sunday and pay peak price. So we went on the Monday and the Tuesday, where we paid less using our Odeon frequent flyer miles cards. Which meant that basically Sharon got to go to the cinema for the first time alone. What was that like?
I don't think it was the first time ever, but it was the first time in a very, very long time.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting experience. I was expecting.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That was your descriptor. First word you thought of.
I'm about to elaborate.
She's doing it in sign.
I'm waiting for you to finish. I was expecting to have difficulty engaging because when I'm surrounded by people, I kind of have an on guard mode, which prevents me from being able to get fully emotionally involved in something. It's mitigated slightly when I'm with you because I kind of tune in to whatever emotional state you're in. And that kind of gives me a fixed point to focus on, which helps me to filter out everybody else. When you're not around and Lyra's not around, it's very difficult for me to filter out everybody else. So I was a little bit wary because I know how much I was emotionally engaged with the first one, and I was a bit worried that I would lose that by seeing it in a cinema full of strangers, particularly if they ended up being a cinema full of chatty strangers.
Yeah, my lot were laughing uncomfortably at the fact that the apes were a bit too human for them. They were like, oh, an ape on a horse, how ruthlessly absurd. And apes on horseback, you must surely know about these films.
You would think, well, I obviously got the better audience of the two.
Yeah. But if you remember when we saw Avatar, you had to go out and lean on a tree because you were kind of, you know, very moved by the whole thing. And, you know, some fuckers just wandered past you going, you've got to hug a tree.
And that was Tunbridge Wells.
Mm. That's like what they sound like.
Posh.
In look, she has to hug a tree. How very gauche.
Indeed. So at the beginning of the film, everybody was kind of, I was like the first person into the cinema and everybody else was coming in dribs and drabs. And it was like the very last minute and people were still coming in. And then there was the obligatory sort of sweet paper rustling and popcorn crunching and ice
grazing
around.
I believe it's termed.
Yeah. But then, very, very quickly, everybody shut the fuck up. And there was barely a peep out of anybody for the rest of the film. There was kind of shocked and people who seemed to be genuinely into what was going on the screen. But there was not a single inappropriate noise out of anybody throughout the whole thing.
I think around about the time when Cobra shot those guys at the gun range, everyone shut up because they were like, okay, it's on now. Mm. And they felt the tension like animals do.
Yeah. But I think you were spot on about, you said to me beforehand that it was immensely tense, and it was, and I could feel it the whole way through. And I actually ended up a lot more engaged than I had even hoped that I would be.
It starts with a global meltdown and sort of taking you through proceedings and how the world got to where it was. And did you notice that the one of the co-stars of Pacific Rim turned up?
Yes, I did.
Everyone sniggered when Obama was on screen. Because he's like the president and that. That's a good joke. Well, no, it's that's to make it feel more real, folks. Exact same shit happened in Pacific Rim. It was really good there. I was obviously totally on board because they told they did such a good job of telling this story and sort of preparing you for it at the end of the first film that it just everything felt like a very natural progression of that. They hadn't twisted things around. In fact, the way it's described before is an unnatural way for things to go. I went back and actually sat down and watched Battle for the Planet of the Apes. The shitty fifth film. And I can pin it down to a couple of things that are really feel wrong about that. And some of the problems actually start in Conquest. It's 17 years after the talking apes, come back in time. At 17 years worth of humans being, I think if you remember the chronology is cats and dogs die and apes, are taken in as house pets and then they are bred bigger and bigger. But a chimpanzee's generation is only eight years. So that can only happen twice. And suddenly they're human-sized apes walking around. And that is actually a thinly veiled reference to the, I suppose it can really be called eugenics involved in the slave trade in America. And the specific picking of overly large, overly athletic slaves and breeding them together to create more strong offspring to work the fields. For the purposes of that, they were again working backwards and going, well, how could we get big apes? But they rushed it. They went too hard and too fast just so they could keep Caesar in there. And the original story from the sounds of it, if they were going to be walking around and talking and being way too human, wrong, totally wrong, too fast. This actually is about as close as you could possibly get to if intelligent apes really did take over the planet. How could it happen? Where it falls down in this case and in the case of Battle is it's too small scale. It's not a planet of the apes. It's a land of the apes. It's a city of the apes. It's a forest of the apes. There is no indication that this is happening anywhere else on the planet. And that's not necessarily something that won't be revealed later on. And also it's not necessarily a failing because we care about these apes. And that's one of the core victories of this film. We care about the humans and the apes. We don't want anyone to get hurt. This is what I was trying for with the Cartographer's Handbook. And what I will continue trying for with New Century. A war where on both sides there are extreme hostilities and you don't want a single shot to go off. An anti-action movie. That's an achievement.
See, that's kind of counter to something that I get a little bit frustrated by when I hear sometimes, which is when people look at a situation where there are hostilities and fall back into, well, there's six of one and a half a dozen of the other. There's faults on both sides.
Yeah, so but, like with Pocahontas.
But a lot of the time, we're not talking two huge armies with equally matched technology, are we? We're talking
the oppressors and the oppressed.
Yeah. And I think the fact that in this it is small scale, that actually really appealed to me because it is two groups which are more evenly matched in the sense that although the humans have guns and therefore technologically speaking, they wildly outmatch the apes. The apes should not stand a chance against them. But the apes seem to have a focus and a persistence that the humans utterly lack. They are wandering around like panicky children.
You say that the humans are technologically advanced. They're technologically dependent. The apes don't need all of these things the humans need.
Yeah, although it did make me smile when the chap said that the apes had an advantage because they didn't need power and this and that. And I'm sat there thinking, well, technically speaking, neither do you. Mm. They don't really have anything that you, needs to be met, or you don't have any needs to be met that they don't. You need food. You need shelter. You have fire. They have fire. But you're kind of fixated on the idea that you need lights and power, and they just haven't got used to that yet.
Yeah. There's very much a, and this is a lot of post-civilization movies are about this, and ultimately the New Century deals with this as well. The idea of restarting civilization, if not necessarily to be what it was before, but to try to overcome the problems that you're facing, to reach, to go back to normality rather than making this new world and the new adapting.
Well, that again
that
is
normality.
Yeah, again, that's something that I'm always going to be slightly off kilter with, when a group of people are basically saying, right, the world has moved on, things have changed, we're now going to fight as hard as we can to try and reverse that and get things back to the way they were before. That's not your world anymore. This is your world now, and the sooner you accept that, the sooner you're going to be able to move forward with it.
And I'm, by the way, super to blame on this scenario as well. I am rubbish at adapting. If I get damp and go for 4 hours without my iPad, I go stir crazy. So I'd be the first scrabbling at the doors going, give us power, we need Wi-Fi. Heading down California way. They had some internet there. So during the elk hunt at the beginning, I was bowled over by the choice of music. Michael Giacchino, he of Star Trek and The Incredibles, and he replaces Patrick Doyle, who worked on Rise, and it's a different score and a different tone. But the music during the elk hunt, it's Luxaturna, or it's paying homage to Luxaturna from 2001 A Space Odyssey. So in the first few moments, after you've had your global pandemic handled exceptionally well and very subtly and without hammering it in with a ballpoint pen into everyone's eye, like Zack Snyder does with the also extremely fun Dawn of the Dead, Civilization's Crumbling opening sequence with Johnny Cash. You get a reference to 2001, Kubrick. It legitimizes and strengthens the story, says, okay, we're going to be playing here seriously. This is not just messing around, and it's not a high octane, metal spinning blockbuster of the kind you're used to. Or even, what was that, 10,000 BC, the one by Roland Emmerich? I suppose that'd be one of the closest ones. Or even Avatar, really. I watched Avatar as well the other day, on the same day, just to, as in following this, just to sort of reacquaint myself, because there are a lot of similarities. And just the glorious action in Avatar, and the sort of, the vengeful natives striking back against the evil oppressing humans, it's a completely different tone to this. We paid attention during film class. And then Michael Giacchino goes and makes something like 19 monkey puns in his soundtrack. Every single one of these tracks. Well, Level Plaguing Field, that's the pandemic that kills the Earth. Look Who's Stalking, The Great Ape Processional, Past Their Primates, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's like a Jack and Daxter series of games. Monkey to the City, The Lost City of Chimpanzee, Along Simian Lines, Caesar No Evil, Hear No Evil, Monkey See, Monkey Coo, one of my favourites, Guerrilla Warfare, easy, The Apes of Wrath, which, by the way, was a Garth Marenghi Dark Place episode name, Give and Take, I'm serious, folks, that's track 13, Aped Crusaders, How Bonobo Can You Go, which must surely be to do with Koba, Enough Monkeying Around, Primates for Life, Planet of the End Credits, and Ain't That a Stinger. So yeah, it's a deadly serious film with a completely flippant soundtrack.
Obviously, he had to let off steam somewhere.
It's not absolutely deadly serious. There are great moments of levity in it that sort of put the audience at ease, and human moments. Again, I'm misusing that word, and it's actually one of the main themes of it, and it's what I mentioned before, what we've been talking about, the notion that what we refer to as humanity, the apes were looking for in each other as well, and it is not exclusive to either humanity or apes. It comes down to a decency. So really, when Caesar stated ape does not kill ape, what he really means is decent people do not kill decent people. And it took him to the end of this film to really understand that. So the bear comes out of nowhere, shocked the hell out of Lyra, who was watching it with us. And just like when we were watching Brave, about 80% more bear than I expected. Just this terrifying bear. This was actually filmed in the woods of British Columbia, by the way. Again, that's an issue I have. Who lives in San Francisco, folks? If you could tell us what these woods are like, because when we saw them in the original, they looked like the woods in Endor, and now suddenly they look like the Pacific Northwest country. It's like the whole thing's filmed in Oregon. I mean, I know it's foggy in San Francisco, but it just looks, it's very dank and dingy and wet, and it's almost like the virus got all the way to the sun and made it weaker. There's no blue skies, there's no golden sunlight anymore.
Given that there was a mention very early on when they were talking about the virus, that some of the symptoms exhibited by the infected apes, which we know not to be the truth, but this would have been what got out, that they exhibited aggressive and violent and threatening behaviour. Rage infected?
It is a bit 28 days later.
It is a little bit 28 days later, yes. Yeah, but what you were saying about the, you know, what was going on elsewhere around the world, ultimately, unless it's too soon after the fact for this to really be anywhere else, unless other labs were experimenting with similar enhancing viruses. Oh, God, no, hang on a minute. I've just thought how it could have spread. If the virus itself does to apes, if it's just caught as a virus rather than actually being administered via a gas or injected, then if the humans who became infected and subsequently died somehow managed to pass it on to other apes in other countries, then they could get smarter instead of keeling over and dying.
I suppose, yeah, if it went to Africa where the the indigenous populations of apes are.
And once it's into the indigenous population, yeah, this goes on long enough that people would still be taking those apes away and taking them to other parts of the world.
But again, the generational thing, it takes a long time for apes to multiply and multiply. It will require it's such a delicate situation, basically, because they require a huge abundance of food to go with this. They have a very specific, they're very picky about what they eat, these various different species around the planet. So they would require all of that food, all of that habitat, no humans around, and I suppose the climate not to change too much for several thousand years.
The hunting makes a significant impact, though. And
they're eating
meat
now.
Do bear in mind that it takes...
That's picky now.
Yeah, well, it takes the virus to make a level of intelligence that Bright Eyes had.
Yeah.
It only takes one generation to then create Caesar.
True.
So, in theory, all of those apes who were intelligent through the exposure to the virus, all of their children, to some degree, to a greater or lesser extent, would have the same opportunity for increased intelligence as Caesar did. If you add to that the fact that they are now hunting, which means that they are now consuming large quantities of protein, which apes in the wild don't do, that they are taking on calorie loads, which apes in the wild have to pretty much eat for the vast majority of their day in order to maintain enough calories to sustain their size, particularly gorillas and orangutans. you add meat into that and they had fire, I'm willing to bet they were eating cooked meat. That's part of what, and we spoke about this briefly before, that's part of what kind of kaboomed humans up into the human realms, was a change in diet that meant that they were getting chemicals. They were ingesting chemicals that they never had before, and they were not having to spend so much of their day in simple pursuit of food, which meant that they had time to pursue other things. And it's not just the chemical building blocks that allows for increased intelligence. It's neuron use. As we said about Caesar growing up in a household and being exposed to the kind of stimulation that a human child would be, even a regular chimp would have the opportunity to increase their intelligence based on that. If, you know, the contrary to spending most of their day interacting with trees and tires on swings.
Yeah. Which leads us to the teaching and the writing, and they're actually, they've got set up rudimentary ape schools when you get back to their camp. And the combination of sign with a little bit of speech is very significant to this movie, because it makes you pay attention to what's being done and said. It means that the bulk of the true communications going on in the movie that you're riveted by is being signed. And you're reading the credits, but it's all about body language. And so you're reading the characters more than you would actors coming on and delivering lines written by Aaron Kruger.
It also means that because you know they can speak, but they don't do it very often, it means that every word they say, you know, is important.
Yeah.
There is not, I mean, this is, I said to you when I got back, there isn't a word or a gesture or a shot or a frame in that film that doesn't mean something.
Yeah.
Nothing is wasted. And compare that to some of the things that we've been exposed to more recently.
Transformers 4, Age of Extinction. 4 hours which are long and a million years to finish.
Hours of bollocks.
Hours of bollocks.
Hours of nothing.
Hours of bollocks. Okay, folks, somebody make a meme of that, just with Optimus Prime. Hours of bollocks. Optimus Prime riding a dinosaur. Hours of bollocks, then this, then credits. You'll be pleased to know, Sharon, by the way, that Andy Serkis got paid a, and this is a quote, healthy seven-figure deal to reappear as Caesar. Now, this is a big deal, because he's a voiceover actor, technically, in the eyes of the Academy. He's a major, major force now. This is not chimp change. That's between $1 and $9 million. They're not just treating him like the guys in the makeup being pushed around. This is based on his performance, and this is based on the fact that people will come back to see that performance. This is a big deal, and that, I think, the monkey lord that Serkis is around powering forwards with performance capture, because this style more than any others interests me, because it's pushing the envelope. It's pushing the uncanny valley. It's not the same, by the way, as sticking a man's face on a baby's body to make it seem like a young Charles Xavier.
No, indeed not.
Or a seven-year-old child's face on a baby's body to make it seem like a freaky, weird vampire baby. That's the opposite. That is forcing computer graphics onto something that really doesn't need it, and that actually would feel much more natural without it. This performance capture is a way of making computer graphics as natural as they can be, and it's pushing that uncanny valley up as far as it'll go. There were points, actually, while I was watching this, specifically where Caesar was sort of in a mid-shot and was not massively angry, but just was sort of standing there, thinking hard, arms down, like thus. And I think that's not performance capture anymore. That's Andy Serkis in an ape suit. Because it really did seem like there was no veil between us anymore. Mm. That was wonderful.
You know the scary thing about him? They don't need power, lights, heat, nothing.
Hey, pal.
That's the advantage. That's what makes them stronger.
Malcolm, I'm thinking one of us should stand guard tonight.
Wait, what? They took our guns.
If they wanted us dead, we'd be dead already.
Maybe they're just taking their time. They already killed off half the planet already.
Come on.
What?
You can't honestly blame the apes.
Who the hell else am I going to blame? It was a simian flu.
It was a virus created by scientists in a lab. The chimps they were testing on didn't really have a say in the matter.
Spare me the hippy-dippy people. You're telling me you don't get sick to your stomach at the sight of them? Huh?
So when they meet the humans and there's the shooting, this is the beginning of the no, don't do anything. No, don't do anything. For the love of God, I know you're going to do something, but please don't do it. And that sustains from pretty much the whole movie. I suppose it makes Caesar's cause our cause because it presents us with a situation where we can see there can be no winner. And yet it doesn't present the aggressors, namely Cobra and what's the guy named? Carver. So
yeah.
Close. And technically, Dreyfus, Gary Oldman, as well as an aggressor. It doesn't present them as being one-dimensional villains. There are times, specifically for the end for Cobra, where he became mad with power, that the shades of grey start to go a lot darker. But for a long time throughout the film, and including the whole time for Oldman's character, very much shades of grey, very much presenting you with characters with lives, with motivations, with pasts, with histories, who believe they're doing the right thing, who are motivated by fear and hate and paranoia, but real organic versions of them rather than cheap imitation pasted on ones. Guy playing Carver, slightly less so. He seems to be sort of painted as a redneck in that kind of, in the same way that the wicked colonel in Avatar just seemed to be just the worst of what America has to bring to us.
See, I saw him as much less so. I mean, the fact that he was the engineer, he was the one who knew how the dam worked. Mm-hmm. So you already know that he is a smart and educated man. Yeah. However, he also seemed terrified the whole way through, and he seemed to be affected by, I mean, maybe it's what we said about technological dependence. If the world moves on from being technologically dependent, where does that leave the mechanics? Where does that leave the engineers? Where does that leave the people who are educated in the ways of and whose life is kind of dedicated to the repair and maintenance of things that humans just aren't using anymore? So if you're in that position, you've kind of got a choice of, do you use those talents to adapt to other things? Because if you're an engineer, you can create new stuff too. Or do you look back and get panicky? And I think when it came down to it, the division, you said about the idea of it being a divide between decent and not decent. I wouldn't frame it quite that way personally.
Right, because Dreyfus most definitely could not be considered indecent.
Not a decent man, no, absolutely. But I would say that there was a division, and a very definite one, between, and I'm going to use the term people to incorporate everybody, including the apes, mm-hmm. but there was a division between people who looked forwards and saw future and saw consequences and tried to do what they could to mitigate those consequences and to make those that future outcomes less harmful and something that would be positive and not cause people to die, and people who not even necessarily looked backwards but just didn't look forwards quite so much, people who would allow impulse to make them act on their emotions and their gut responses without really thinking through what the end result of that would be. Mm. And they did that for various different reasons, you know, and all of their emotional reactions and their what was driving them seemed perfectly understandable. It was just, I recognized the frustration in seeing them escalate things so quickly out of maybe fear of not acting in time. We talked about this before on the X-Men podcast, the difference between Magneto and Charles. One of the distinctions between them being that Charles would talk and think and work through everything that was going on and where everything was likely to go and end up running the risk of not acting at all. Whereas Eric was, more act now, sort out the mess later. And that's an oversimplification in their case, but I think that was something that started to come through with Caesar, and I can see this ending up being cause for him to query his ability to lead, particularly as he gets older, that he is a thinker. He plans, he feels things very, very deeply, and it hurts him so much when others are harmed that he will avoid taking action if it means that harm can be avoided, even if that ends up meaning that other harm is done from a different direction. Does that make sense?
It does. I was looking for a relationship of Charles and Eric proportions between Caesar and Cobra, because there are obviously a lot of similarities there. The harm that has been vested on Cobra, brilliantly exemplified when Caesar mentions human work and Cobra points to his various scars and coldly intones,
"Human work. Human work."
Points to his ruined eye.
"Human work."
This is someone who has been treated like a concentration camp victim. And I think I was hoping for more uncertainty in Cobra. Maybe that he would do what it took to punish and to attack the humans, but he would never actively attack and shoot and hurt or attempt to kill Caesar. And that went completely out of the window when he decided, when Caesar beat him to the ground and then he got up and swore fealty and extended his hand for supplication. At that point, already he had decided, "Nah, I'm done here. I am going to get you in a different way. Obviously, brute strength is not going to work here." And from then on, he was scheming and plotting, and there was nothing more of what we could refer to as humanity in him. He was just acting on out of vengeance on everyone, and became Megatron-like levels of megalomaniacal and murderous by the end, which I guess was disappointing, because I wanted that dimension of just a moment for Cobra of going, "What have I done here?" Even if he just carried on, moving on, but just like to stare at all the other apes being killed and thinking to himself, "They're doing this for me. Or are they?" And just rationalize it in some way and then snap himself out of it. But he was played by Toby Kebbell this time. It was a chap named Christopher Gordon the first time. And it's an astonishing performance. So whether or not Cobra went in the direct, went directly towards the black or not, it's all pretty much a level with Serkis at times. Just in being able to express himself physically through the technology, through the guise of the ape. He gave Cobra a black burning soul.
I think you can see as well how, because unlike the others, or some of the others who act very much on impulse, and the bulk of those being humans actually, because you know Cobra's history, because you know what's driving him, it's not purely gut natural instinct, because his instincts have been twisted and molded into something so jagged and so brittle that his actions kind of compounded onto each other. So everything he did that initially may have been completely understandable, and though you may not necessarily have agreed with his methods, you thought, "Well, yeah, I can kind of see what that's born out of." And to an extent, he's right to be wary. But then the more and more he layered action which was entirely without real justification. I mean, for me, the turning point was when he killed Ash.
Well, yeah, he was demanding that his apes murder unarmed humans, and that already that's a turning point. And then he pushed that over the edge, literally, by turning that into anybody who refuses to do my bidding here. Suddenly, he becomes Megatron. Will suffer the same consequences.
But I think, because I think a lot of
then
people
would
say
almost no going back.
Yeah, a lot of people would say that the turning point was when he shot Caesar.
Yeah.
But that I could kind of see the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle that he was trying to assemble at that stage. He wanted to initiate something that would cause the humans to no longer be allowed to interact with the apes.
In the same way that Eric could close himself off to kill Mystique in order to do what he perceived as the greater good.
Yeah, but once that was done and he received no punishment for it, at least not immediately, I think that's what then caused him to completely go over the edge into what could be interpreted as kind of comic book villain black. But I don't think that I would still even put it in that category, because the whole point of those ridiculously one-dimensional villains is that you don't know any of their motivations at all. You know where Cobra's come from, and that makes all the difference, at least to me.
It was almost directly in parallel with the time when he picked up the gun for the first time. Suddenly, when he's got the gun, that starts sending him down a darker and darker path, because it becomes so easy to end a life.
Yeah. Well, it's very easy to see how that is somebody who's felt that all their power has been taken away from them in their life, that everything that they are has been stripped from them. They've been treated like an object, like a thing with no concept of their personhood or their right to not be injured or their right to not be starved or their right not to have bits cut off them in the name of medical testing. And being given the formula that increased his intelligence was Cobra's first taste of power. And the look on Jacob's face, first of all, when he realized that it worked, when Cobra wrote his name.
Yeah.
And secondly, when he was in the helicopter and Cobra pushed him off the side.
Yeah.
Tastes of power that pushed him further and further on to try and reclaim that. And again, like Eric, to draw a line in the sand and say, this will never happen to me again. He's not in a place where he can think of it in terms of the world has moved on, medical testing labs no longer really exist, that is never going to happen to me again. It can't possibly, he can't think that way. All he thinks is, humans, this is what they've done to me. Shred.
It is to the credit of the writers of the two X-Men, young Eric and Charles films, that they managed to keep Eric so multidimensional. They haven't sent him down that path, you know, that he can't come back from, that he's no longer relatable anymore. Even though we would still have an understanding of where he is. Once you get to the point where Cobra got, it's very hard to root for him anymore. And that the magic of Fassbender's Magneto is that for most of the time you're thinking, guy's got a point. But with Cobra, you're presented so repeatedly with the chance for just peaceful moving forwards and for non-violence that it's just so galling and frustrating. Yes, he's got a point, but every single move he makes only makes things worse.
And he knows that, and he continues to do it. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right, because you see the things that he's doing, and you, again, it's...
Eric is aware of things on a global, and in the case of Days of Future Past, historical scale. Cobra can only really see what's in front of his face, which is...
He has a very narrow view, yeah.
So let's get off the whole Eric and Cobra train, because we'll come back to Cobra later on for the climax. Okay, so the central trio of humans, Malcolm, Ellie, and Alex, played by Jason Clarke, Kerry Russell, and Cody Smith McPhee. Was Cody familiar to you? The young lad. Very clean face.
He looked like Jay Baruchel, but apart
he
from
did.
That...
It's the kid in The Road.
Oh, my God.
He's grown up
he
a bit.
He's sprung up a bit.
He's in a slightly less depressing world. But he appears to be duty-bound to be in dark futures.
Mm. He's harnessed all of that onflux of misery, though.
Yeah. To Jason Clarke's credit, I have never much enjoyed seeing him on screen in film, and I was very much on board for Malcolm. It didn't take long for me to go, right, okay, this character's a straight shooter. He's not massively fascinating or interesting, but he is a decent fixed point in the absence of Will for us to relate to the apes. And he has that, I love the bit where he's looking at the pistol and then just puts it back in the drawer because there's just no point. What is the point of bringing a pistol with me? If I shoot an ape that's threatening me, everyone's going to die anyway. So what's the point?
I think what struck me the most about him was how his driving force was very, very simple. And it was one that you rarely see in heroes.
Certainly not Marky Mark.
Well, I wasn't going to say it. Basically, everything he was doing...
No, Marky
everything.
Mark is very simple, but his driving force was complex. Carry on.
Everything that Malcolm was trying to achieve was for the sake of his son.
Yeah.
And that idea of the small family unit... within the larger family community was very, very strong. And it was reinforced by, obviously, Caesar's connection with Cornelia and and Blue Eyes and his newborn son. And it really gave that feeling of the parallel worlds that... what's the ridiculously clichéd comment that Sting did a song about, do the Russians love their children or something like that?
Yes, we bloody do, I believe they said.
Well, indeed, but it just...
He said he hoped that the Russians love their children too. Yeah, which country was it that first called for nuclear disarmament? No, unilateral nuclear disarmament? I think it was Russia, actually, yes.
Oh, I think Russia has forfeited any right to have their boxes ticked at the moment.
Yeah, okay. Right now, Russia is run by a different crowd, but Gorbachev was a good egg.
He wasn't bad. But yeah, anyway, to get off politics.
Look, does Vladimir Putin love his children too? Sting would like to know.
Right, the significant point is not does he love his children, but do his children love him?
loves them as long as they're not gaylords.
Well, indeed. But yeah, the idea of people interacting with other people with no casual death because it doesn't matter because they're henchmen or they're robots or they're brown people in a foreign country or whatever reason they ascribe to their film or video game that basically means that these are not actually people. They are a detached thing that it is okay for us to off for the in the name of action.
For your amusement.
Indeed. The total absence of that blew me away. And to replace that, that strong... supposed strong, warlike, everybody can get behind this flag that we're waving because it's, you know, all in the name of freedom with family and community and the idea of supporting each other and doing things for other people and not for some obscure concept of doing this for your children because you don't really give a shit about your children. If your idea of the world that you're going to pass on to your children is one in which they have to stand on the pile of dead bodies that you just massacred, then you're not really thinking about your children here. You're doing something to satisfy some urge within yourself. And that strong feeling of how family and groups that all connect with each other, and even the individuals who don't connect, the people who are trying to keep the network together are trying to bring those individuals in and trying desperately to include them and not just abandon them and say, you don't meet the rules, right, exile, that's the end of it. Carver, when he transgresses all of the boundaries that Caesar's laid down and brings a shotgun into the camp, I was half expecting him to be like banished, like walk back to the city, and if you die on the way, you die on the way. But no, there was none of that. They were, you know, they were cross with him. They were very firm with him, but they basically took him back to the truck and went, right, you stay there. We will take you home in a bit when we're done with what we're doing. He was treated almost like a naughty child, where you understand why the child's done it, but you still have to mete out some sort of punishment so that they understand not to do it again. And that, again, it just, there was so much that seemed to me to be real about this.
This was more like World War Z than the World War Z movie.
Yes.
There you go, folks.
Absolutely.
It had awareness of consequences and the future.
Yeah. Genuine and authentic and real. And like you say, the fact that they have now got to the point where
Notice they weren't racing around for trying to find a cure.
Well, indeed. The idea, they'd have to test it on apes. Really, would it? That could have dire consequences.
Now they've become like the brain gremlin.
The fact that they've now got the CGI up to a level where realism is not in question. It's the blend between CG performance and live action actor was so seamless. The one moment where it got a little bit uncanny valley for me was the baby chimp, because obviously the baby chimp does not have a baby performance capture actor.
That's very true. Even with baby Caesar, they had to actually have a baby lying in a box, because Andy Serkis could not, and this is from the commentary, get into a box of that size. He tried. but the scale was all wrong, so they used a baby for reference. And obviously with that, they can't get a baby to clamber all over a human of that size. So, they
could have used a baby chimp.
Yeah. But you can't make a baby chimp too specifically.
You can't stick dots all over a baby chimp and not expect it to eat.
I would imagine they examined file footage of baby chimps moving all over people and then tried their absolute level best to imitate that. But there wasn't a frame-for-frame reference.
Yeah. But still, I mean, you compare that to the small ape-like creature that climbs all over people in Lost in Space.
Blarp. I was thinking of Blarp.
And it's a different... It's a different universe.
Yeah. And that's what all the apes would be like if they were just using CG but didn't use performance capture.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have that reference.
Yeah. They'd look better, but they wouldn't move better.
Would they look better?
As in they'd look better than Lost in Space level CG.
Oh, right, yeah. So there's no way they could look better than these. They literally... No. It's not specifically better. It's what I mentioned before about the little tiny imperfections make it seem perfect. The little scars, the little wobbles, the little moments where there's an organic feel behind them. Mm-hmm. Again, just wonderful stuff.
The matted fur that makes it look like a suit rather than a digital texture.
Maurice, this time, when she was I call her she because obviously it's a female. She's played by Karen Connival, the woman who wouldn't let Will sign the papers. So I always kind of feel like Maurice has a female energy to her, to him. The bit where Maurice was staring at Alex from outside the tent, just with these curious two little yellow eyes in this massive face, just crested on all sides, and then the very gentle moving forwards, and the end result of that was simply they read a comic book together. That was utterly wonderful. And that's the sort of thing that basically only really happens. It doesn't happen in blockbuster movies. It happens in things like Ghost World. It happens in indie films.
That's what we're looking for, really, isn't it? Indie
small
sensibilities.
Things. Small things mixed with
big budgets.
No, small things with big premises. Yeah?
Yes, sorry, rather than big budgets. Big ideas.
Yeah.
Small details, big ideas.
Yeah. If everything's trying to be big all the time, there's a point where you can't relate to it. It's just everyone's posturing. Everything's huge. There's explosions so often that you just become numb to it. And you just, okay, right. When everything just calms the fuck down, then can we reconnect? People know this on an unconscious level. People know this when they go in to see films. They say, well, you got to switch your brain off. You shouldn't have to switch your brain off. Sometimes it's important to switch your brain off. Absolutely, I agree. There are plenty of films where you can do that. But really, with the big budgets, we don't necessarily... Like, you can switch your brain off with Ninja Assassin. You don't need to waste north of $250 million for a switch your brain off film.
What did we see the other day that was switch your brain off that I liked?
Talk.
Talk, yes, Talk.
Yeah, switch your brain off with Talk, absolutely. That's. I want to start a campaign. As well as Maurice, who it was fantastic to see back, Rocket returned. And it was touching to see how connected he was to Caesar now. How loyal and how he wouldn't dream of betraying him now. Because Caesar basically showed him a better life than being the asshole he was. And that's possibly why I felt I was frustrated for Carver. Because Carver... There was a moment when when Caesar Jr., the little baby chimp, was jumping around on Ellie's knee, and he softened a little bit, almost like he was being reminded of maybe a toddler that he had a while back. And then he hardened up and got angry again, and then the shotgun got found. And it's almost like there was going to be something, and then he got beaten to death by Cobra. But, you know, life is messy, and you don't get to have fully rounded off characters all across the board, and you don't get to tie up every thread. I guess it was beginning to feel like Mass Effect 2, and everybody had a story, and everybody had a past, and everybody had motivations, and I wanted to find out all of them and then see them through to the end.
But you can't always.
It wasn't time.
One thing it really reminded me of, actually, was that... When I was younger, and possibly this is to do with having more time, and when I say younger, I mean like literally 10, 11, 12 years old. I used to, basically anybody I saw who caught my attention for whatever reason, and lots of people did. I was very much a people watcher when I was younger. And I used to invent little stories for all the people around me. And create little interactive worlds that I couldn't possibly know anything about. And these people would have histories and they would have backstories. And it sounds like, I think some people would see it as divorcing myself from the reality of those people. But in all fairness, if I'm never going to meet them and they're, actual stories are never going to become known to me. It was actually a way of seeing them as people rather than just crowds or, you know, people behind tills who take your money and give you your shopping. And it hit me that as I've got older, whether it's got easier or whether it's become more of a habit to just push people that I don't directly personally interact with into this kind of background level where they're, and I'm not saying that I don't actually see them as human beings. I don't see them as people, but just that I don't feel any sense of connection with them. As I don't see any parallel between them and me. And I honestly don't think that that's because there's anything wrong with my brain and I'm not going to suddenly flip out and kill anybody or anything ridiculous like that.
I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah. But all I mean is I've lost the habit of really seeing what lies behind the superficial conversations and the superficial interactions. And
refuge in fiction?
Well, no, because it could be argued that that's what I was doing before. But this kind of reminded me that, to put it in really, really simplistic terms, that every pair of eyes I see has something behind it.
I understand what you mean. The key words repeated throughout a family, and the reason it works on this small scale is that you're dealing with a bunch of close-knit families, and those are much easier to relate to because it's simple. You don't have to get tied in with the politics that they're all beholden to. These people are separate from the rest of them. They don't know what's going on in the rest of the world. They are as clued in as Caesar and his group. They're isolated groups. And when that's the case, it becomes a very simple scenario of survival. And if both tribes want to survive and can somehow see their way clear to not murdering each other, it's better for everyone. That really is, you know, it's a simple way of kind of summing up life. You know, the secret of life, if we're going to sort of get through it, if two tribes, if not two, why not more, just want to survive, is it possible they cannot kill each other? And yet it manages to project this without being preachy, without going for direct allegory, and just making it applicable to life. So that when that whole premise falls apart and the apes start charging in with their guns and they clash, as I said before, it becomes like Saving Private Ryan. You just kind of want it to stop. It's relentless. It's a sensory overload, but it's done in the right way, as opposed to Transformers, where it's like, you want this, don't you? No, we don't. And I hate to keep comparing it to Transformers, but it's what we've been covering recently. And it's a nice state of affairs when Apes comes out a few weeks after the lackluster performance of Age of Extinction. It's still, you know, it did close to a billion, but it only did close to a billion.
Ah, the inevitable drop-off begins.
Yeah. Thank the Lord. Some people are catching on. And Apes has done extremely well. Blue Eyes, who was played by Nick Thurston. Again, these are all names that people won't know. You know, Nick Thurston, Terry Notary, who was the guy who played Rocket in the first one, and Karen Connivel as Rocket and Maurice, and Judy Greer, who played Cornelia, Caesar's wife. She's Cheryl from Archer. And what's her name in Arrested Development? Kitty.
Kitty, that's it.
Yeah. Unrecognizable. Could not have told that about Cornelia, and yet incredibly subtle, quiet performance. You were asking why the apes, the midwife apes, had their faces covered.
Mm-hmm.
I was speculating either it was something Caesar and company remembered from watching surgeons in the past, that they wore masks, and so it's like, well, it's just something that got done. However, it's more likely that it was something ceremonial, because Cornelia was wearing a headdress, which to indicate that she was the matriarch at the moment. And there are other hints that with the spears and the hunting together in packs and on horseback eventually, that they're basically dropping into advancing along the same lines as man did, and that they're developing their own culture. And these sort of occurrences are natural. But Blue Eyes, back to Nick Thurston, I honestly thought that at some point Caesar was going to die, and that they'd find him, because obviously when a person gets shot in the shoulder and they fall out of sight, obviously they're not dead, especially if they're a key character, and that the film goes on without them, when the reintroduction of their character would turn everything around again. But I thought they were going to bring him back, and then when they got him to Will's house, he might actually die, and it would be fall to Blue Eyes, who had to decide to stand up and take his father's crown and beat Simba, effectively. Mm. And that actually would still have been a really great movie. as it is, they managed to delineate the difference between Caesar and Blue Eyes. That still may, by the way, happen in the third film. I have some wild speculation for what might happen there. We'll do that at the end. Thurston played it extremely quiet, extremely subtle, almost shy for a son of Caesar. He could and should possibly be more boisterous, be more assertive, but he's been quiet, it seems, for a lot of his life, and the attack from the bear at the beginning humbles him further, and then all of the conflict, he appears to not thrive on conflict. And so, again, this is an introverts movie. Mm-hmm. This one and Rise, they are movies for introverts. Age of Extinction, extrovert. That's not saying extroverts are worse. I once believed introverts were better than extroverts, but not anymore.
What do we do? Go!
Shall we shoot him?
Maybe.
Oh.
Oh, hey,
hey, hey. Hey.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
Hey, hey, hey.
I think he likes you. Oh, you want a drink? Give him some nasty weapons.
There you go.
Whoa, whoa, hey, hey.
Okay.
Whoa, 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 hey, hey. Whoa. Oh. Yeah. That's good, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, whoa, hey, hey, hey,
hey. Hey, okay, all right.
Easy.
Yeah.
Easy.
Easy.
Lyra kept pointing out the window symbol. It turned up several times in the camp before they actually got to Will's house. And when the power was restored and Caesar got to watch that video, which they very cunningly put on high 8 tapes, which would have been still around in 2018 that Caesar was that the virus started to spread. So it's actually 2028 when this movie takes place. So Caesar would have been a small child ape around about 2012, 2011. High 8 or digital tapes with the little sounds they were using there would still have been around for cameras. And also, I remember seeing that on the trailer going, there's no way the battery would still be going. It was plugged in. That's a neat little twist.
I noticed that too.
A little bit of detail. I hate it when things happen in movies that just wouldn't fucking happen. If anybody ever finds a Zippo lighter, for example, anyone who's ever owned a Zippo lighter will tell you that if you leave that thing in your old coat pocket or a drawer for 3 or 4 months and you come back to it, there's no lighter fluid left. It evaporated ages ago. But every time they find them in movies, click, and it comes straight on. Bollocks to that. But when Dreyfus finds the iPad, a wonderful moment of visual storytelling. Not a word is spoken, and Lyra was in floods because she understood exactly what was going on. She's my touchstone for how well visual storytelling is working. And she was actually getting really good at reading the subtitles as well. They were whipping by, but she was getting what was being said because in context it made sense. I was afraid that she'd get too overwhelmed by the action and the violence, and obviously going in not knowing what was going to happen, not knowing if Caesar would actually straight out die, I didn't want her to be absolutely distraught. But, you know, it happened to a generation of kids who saw Optimus Prime die, and they had no knowing that might happen, so we didn't turn out too bad.
Indeed.
And again, Dreyfus didn't get the chance, much like Carver, to actually think on his very determined course, which is to just give everything to destroy the apes and to just prevent their chance of destroying his family. And had it been played by an actor with lesser of a caliber than Oldman, or had Oldman been playing it totally loopy, which he has been prone to do at times, specifically prior usually to Batman Begins, and I'm sure he could still do one, he would just have been a hateable, detestable character, like everyone in Battle for the Planet of the Apes. Instead, I completely got why he felt this had to be done, why he would give his life to do it. Again, it felt like World War Z. And this brings us to the fight between Caesar and Cobra, and there's not really much to say about the confluence of the action itself, aside from the fact that notably at one point, did you see Caesar leapt down onto Cobra in a death dive? Like something that he pretty much knew he was going to die doing. Exactly the same as... In order to help and save his friends and just take down this force that was going to doom them all otherwise. Buck.
Ah, yeah.
Buck inspired him with his actions. And when he states... Cobra states Caesar weak, and Caesar retorts Cobra weaker. This comes down to the fact that Cobra has no friends. Cobra has no confidants, and Caesar really knows this. He doesn't have a cell of operatives. He doesn't have a system in place, even just professionally, to remain where he is. He doesn't have the strength to stay in on his teetering pedestal. And Caesar knows that he is loved, which gives him the strength it takes to win. Kind of like Rocky.
Yeah. Well, it comes back to the apes alone weak, apes together strong. And his symbol for family, I don't know if that is accurate to the ASL sign for family, but the way he does the two thumb and forefinger together and move them apart before doing the gesture for all together, that almost
That's
looked
accurate.
Like, okay, well, that looked to me like the gesture he made when he was holding the sticks to show Maurice what he meant about apes together strong.
Yeah. Well, he would back then have known the sign for family, and so would Maurice.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah. Because that's the thing. That's the reason Caesar didn't leave in the cages in the original Rise. He saw a family. He saw the potential for people like him. And I use the term people here. Which is why show of force, which is why he rode them all into town to just threaten the humans, which is why he would have to remain strong. He has to actually perform these leadership duties. He can't just ponder and think and ruminate and hope for peace.
I loved his comment about apes look for the strongest branch.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing, that if he's thinking in metaphors and he's thinking in allegory, then the next step is stories. And that's the point at which I think this concept of the transition from animal state to human state, or animalistic state to human state, is where you have the concept of something that is bigger than you and bigger than your group and bigger than your community and will carry on into the future beyond you and all your children being dead. And if you have stories, then you've got a history, and if you've got a history, then you're eternal.
When Cobra dies, there was just enough of a breakfall as he went down for them to possibly bring him back for the third, which got me thinking, how the hell can they follow this up? If we're looking into the distant future of a Charlton Heston type getting out of this new version of Icarus into a planet of the apes, there's really only one way this can go, which is that apes continue to evolve, continue to culturally move forward and expand outwards, and man devolves. Something may happen that basically makes men into simpletons. Mm. That's actually a really depressing way to end a trilogy. I originally... compared this loosely to the Two Towers before seeing it, but now it really feels like this was an exact perfect example, midpoint, of what Weta did with the Two Towers and making it really character-based, making it really drama-based and tension-based with a war where you don't want people to get horribly hurt. And then sort of, you know, this is the battle for Helm's Deep is over. The battle for Middle Earth is just beginning. And so what do you think could happen?
I think it depends how many more they want to do. In all seriousness, if the next one is going to be the last one, I would be tempted to move past Caesar because we've seen him fall. It would be very difficult to see him fall again in a way that isn't repeating itself. So if you move on to the next generation, have Caesar relatively long dead and Blue Eyes leading.
Yeah.
And look at what they do next. Look at what happens when you have a generation of apes for whom human rule is starting to pass out of living memory. Because that's a key step in the treatment of the humans starting to get to what you had in the original Heston movie. It's not just that the humans have to become less smart. The apes have to forget that one time they were more intelligent and more dominant than they are now.
Also, one of the things that held back the original Planet of the Apes was the rather ham-fisted stab at religion. The whole idea that this religious doctrine prevents the scientific discovery and historical uncovering of what happened before. And the priests going, no, you must not look, you must not think. And, you know, we've got plenty of things which can make ham-fisted stabs at religion nowadays. But that prevented us from really seeing any kind of advanced ape society. So if they're going to introduce that again in this, it's going to actually be not very subtle.
Yeah, well, that's the difficulty with allegory, isn't it? Because if we move on to the point where the apes are starting to show all of what we would consider to be human flaws and foibles,
they're going
to
come across religion. They can't not, really.
No.
That's what tribal man did. You don't immediately jump to being atheists if that is the most advanced state of mind on the planet.
You'd have to... Well, I think if you bear in mind that early...
Not saying it is, by the way, folks.
Early religion...
Don't want to piss off any...
kind of an attempt to make sense of what is not yet understood.
Mm-hmm.
Magic is basically just the things we don't understand yet. And again, the apes that have a memory of what it was like living under, if you like, humans, the apes who remember technology, the apes who remember scientific constructions and things, even if they don't have a full understanding of how it worked, they would at least not think of it as magic. And there's no reason for them to take that route. But then you're getting into unscrupulous leaders doing what Cobra did and basically lying to them in order to keep them under control.
Yeah, you're going to get to the Roman stage.
I mean, that is
which
once
is
you get
the Tim
past,
Burton version.
Yeah, once you get past the idea of attempting to explain the inexplainable, religion becomes a very efficient stick with which to beat the masses.
Yeah. One thing they did remove from this film, there was going to be a post-credit sting which is even like the music is present on the soundtrack, where a giant battleship comes under the San Francisco Bridge and closes in on them. But they decided to remove that because that boxes them in. For a start, they're going to be foolhardy if they get rid of Andy Serkis. Just because Caesar's not there doesn't mean that Serkis doesn't need to be there. Roddy McDowell carried on long after the death of Cornelius. Ergo, you could have Caesar the Fifth if you do want to just... I mean, because ultimately, what can it really be? There's two things that can happen, basically. Either the apes win, in which case mankind is doomed and it's a miserable, gloomy ending, or the humans win and the apes are doomed and it goes back to not being Planet of the Apes. Or more apes turn up, and it's, this is a bigger thing than you thought. It is actually a Planet of the Apes. The African apes have somehow become seafaring. And then you're starting to stretch that realism that they were trying to go for. Mm-hmm. So really, when it comes down to it, if you're going to keep it realistic and you're going to keep moving forwards and you're actually going to approach how the original 68 Planet of the Apes presented itself, humans have to start dying out in some way that isn't utterly depressing. Or it needs to have moved forward to the point where you're like, okay, humans are now becoming an endangered species and the apes are trying to keep them alive. Featuring Caesar the Fifth, played by Andy Serkis. I don't know. But I do like the fact that at the end of our apes podcast, eight down the line, we're back to square one again. As in, how do we get to Charlton Heston? One of the most appealing factors about this is its looping state of time.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we know that if they're going to get back to that point, they have to get to New York.
But yeah, the apes are going to have to start spreading, heading east in effigy of great west.
Oh, God,
that's their
yes.
wild east.
Oh, good Lord.
Colonizing.
Yeah. Spreading across the...
Which is why, really, if we rejoin it several decades or even a couple of hundred years from now, when things are very different. Then again, people are very much engaged with what this is. And that may be the sort of thing that can happen in another trilogy that follows after this one. Maybe the whole point of this is the Caesar dynasty, and that the film 3 will close that one out. He will die, and we will have to deal with that. And then that was his epic Caesar trilogy, and then they can move on with the future for the series. Because really, why stop it there at this point with, you know, a sort of a cliffhanger for what's going to happen at the end of the story? Well, some stuff happened, but let's move on. If you remember, that's pretty much what they did with Battle of the Planet of the Apes. They went, some stuff happened, it's not even clear what year this is, let's move on. Yet Caesar's still around. Yet this guy whose brother worked in the government is still around. Yet a city of indeterminate name is still populated by mutants with scarred faces. Yet the apes are talking, wearing clothes. There's one ape who won't shut up, named Virgil. It doesn't make any sense. But these do. And that's one of the many, many reasons I love them. So, yeah, I think we got us a really excellent and unexpected new trilogy emerging here. And the first one to not concern superheroes for quite some time. This occurred to me after I'd written all these notes. This film starts with Caesar's eyes very, very close up on them. And he's in the jungle and he's in the forest and he's staring down at what we find out shortly afterwards at the elk. And it just sort of pulls out slowly, slowly from these incredibly intense eyes. And he's got this face paint on, which I don't know whether it's inadvertent or purposeful. He's made his face skeletal. And he even has like sort of rib bones striped across his chest. And he's made himself into this specter of something that would be very frightening to a human. And it slowly pans out. And then he sends his apes on and they hunt the elk. And then it closes on his eyes, and he's staring forwards into the camera, ruminating on everything that's happened throughout the film, thinking about what's about to happen, and all of that massive mixture of emotion. It's kind of like the end of The Long Good Friday with an ape. And it reminded me of the beginning of Rise, where you zoom in to Brighteyes' eyes just as she's been captured and taken away from her jungle home, and it zooms out and her irises change and they go green, and she's suddenly intelligent, very intelligent and very sad, and then that's her story there. And there's just many times when it just focuses on the eyes of Caesar. It doesn't end on his eyes rise, but these, again, it's the eyes. And this is one of the things that I find so difficult about writing, Sharon. Mm-hmm. I keep describing people's eyes because I am such a visual storyteller. I can't say over and over again, he looked incredibly intense. You know, she could see in his eyes that blah, 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 blah. If I keep talking about the eyes, it seems like a crutch I'm leaning on. But if you show it subtly in a film, it's like you don't have to say those things because they're all open to interpretation. One person could see that ape's eyes and not see anything at all. Or you could see tons. That's what I love about visual storytelling. That's what I love about the screen. Part of what took me by surprise with Cobra was his incredible cunning when he was in a very sticky situation in the armory, and the guy's got his gun trained on him, and there's just this sort of, oh my god, what's he going to do? How is he going to basically somehow turn the tables and kill this guy? Because that's the murder is all over his face, and then he just goes into Clyde mode. Did people laugh at that stage? You're supposed to.
They did, yeah, but I think in a way that, as you say, you're intended to.
Yeah.
It's a breaking of the tension for the guy sat there as well as for the audience.
Yeah. It's also kind of, well, the clever balls on this guy moment. And to then realize that that intellect and that reasoning and that cunning is now being pitted against Caesar ups the tension even more. And it's like, oh, that relieves the tension. Oh, wait a second, the tension's now back. So, yeah, extremely well managed. And thankfully, Matt Reeves will be directing this next one.
Excellent.
Yeah. And again, this is a Fox movie. And I've got to hand it to them right now. They've managed to churn out several X-Men films and Apes films without meddling. I don't know what new management they went through since X-Men Origins Wolverine, but it was enough to basically get them to go back to the drawing board and go, right, are we able to just let filmmakers be filmmakers? And of course it goes without saying that in a few years' time, 2016, we will be reviewing War of the Planet of the Apes, or whatever it's called. Okay, that will do it from us. Coming up in the next few weeks, the run-up to the 30th episode of Digital Drift, which will be my 400th podcast, and it's the Iron Giant. And in the meantime, Guardians of the Galaxy. We will see you in a week's time. I've been Alex Shaw.
I've been Sharon Shaw.
And Neural
Handshake complete.